You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and to the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. Today we've got a seasonal special. We're delving into the traditions of Easter foods. Now, Easter's one of those big food moments. It's a frantic time for the industry. So we thought we'd take a look at the past, a look at the history and symbolism of Easter food, which goes way beyond hot cross buns and Easter eggs. We're going to explore the Easter dishes traditionally served around the world, but also look ahead to the new trends that might emerge in years to come. Our guide to the traditions of Easter is a wonderful historian, author, and archaeologist at the University of York. You'll have seen her expert historical influence on your telly box in programmes like Gentleman Jack, amongst many others. It is the fantastic Dr. Emma Wells. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you for having me.
Ah, it's a great pleasure. It's brilliant to have you. So first question, the obvious question, can you flip a pancake successfully?
Yes, after several attempts.
Just persevere, keep going.
Yeah, practice makes perfect.
I think it works like that. Okay, so first of all then, let's dig deep into this. We can't avoid the reason for Easter. The context is crucially important. Although kids love Christmas, Easter is easily the most important festival in Christianity. Can you talk us through its significance?
Yeah, well, Easter is obviously the time of Jesus's resurrection. So we have 40 days leading up to Easter. It's the period of Lent. So a lot of our traditions actually are associated, perhaps more so with Lent than Easter, but they go hand in hand. Mm. However, is it just a Christian tradition? That's where the discussion comes up. The word Easter, or Eostre, as we think it derives from, is actually an Anglo-Saxon goddess of spring. Now, Eostre, she transformed a bird into an egg-laying hare companion, hence the Easter Bunny connection, perhaps. But we don't think that was actually the person that we're talking about. But the only surviving mention of Easter, as we would know it, or Eostre, was the 8th century historian, the Venerable Bede. He talks about Eostre Monath, or Eostre Month, which was, she was a goddess. And so feasts were celebrated in her honour at the time of spring. And therefore, after that, you get the connection with Christianity and the date of Easter, which is sort of calculated based on Jewish calendar, which we'll go into. But it's all around this sort of springtime, the idea of renewal and rebirth.
Mm-hmm. Now, so we have to sort of think about Christianity as a relatively recent affair, really. I mean, it's 2,000 odd years ago. And when Christianity came in and it began to take over a lot of traditions that were already there, it had to subsume them, didn't it? I think what you were saying earlier on is that there are elements of other cultures in dates. So, for instance, Christmas and Easter might have had other significance, and that what Christianity had to do in order to basically subvert what was already there was to encompass it and then to renew it. Is that the case?
I suppose, in short, yes. And Easter by no means is alone in this. We see the same with Christmas, etc. So many of our Christian feasts do have origins in paganism and previous to that. So there are lots of sort of traditions that were just reborn and rebirth, and there was great Renaissance and flair to this. But Christianity, and obviously Easter itself, has its origins in the Jewish faith. And the connection to Passover.
Yeah.
Christ was seen as the new Pascha, and the celebration of the resurrection became the first Christian feast, and Easter was referred to as Paschal month in connection with Paschal, Passover, and also the Paschal lamb, which is the sacrificed lamb. So it all sort of goes hand in hand, and then we get the idea of the egg, and again, renewal, rebirth, Renaissance.
Absolutely, yeah, the cycle. So we're talking about feasts here. Why is food so central to these enormous events in religion and in culture generally?
A lot of these are times of gathering, of sharing, of coming together. So these events do have, of course, significance and symbolism and theological implications to them all. But essentially, it's a time of, when we come to Lent, it's a time of sacrifice, it's a time of penitence. So then it's a celebration of the fact that you've achieved that, and that you, again, that word again is renewal. You are a renewed person. Yes. And you have managed to achieve that. So it's feasting, I suppose, is at the very heart of all this.
Yeah, and feasting is festival, I guess, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay, so now The Last Supper, obviously famous for Leonardo da Vinci's picture of The Last Supper, in which we see fish, lots of bread, bits and pieces, but that's not necessarily what The Last Supper was. Can you talk a little bit about The Last Supper, its significance and the relationship to the Eucharist?
I mean, it's very important, obviously, to the Easter festival and everything, but the Synoptic Gospels, so Matthew, Mark and Luke, they presented the Last Supper as a Passover Seder, so the Jewish ceremonial meal, yes, when the wine and bread was representing Christ's blood and body. Some items do appear to be missing in the Last Supper in relation to the Jewish Seder, but that's pretty much the same sort of meal. And therefore, that's again why we get this idea of Christ as the new Pascha, because it's Latin for Passover, and the celebration therefore became the first Christian feast. So,
and there's lots of different versions of the Last Supper. There's a painting of the Last Supper in the Cusco Cathedral which features what looks suspiciously like a guinea pig to be feasted. And that's, it's really interesting because people will take the concept of this and insert it into their own culture. And again, it's subsuming the concept and adapting it to what you already know, I guess. And so the Eucharist is interesting because the concept is that you are tasting the blood and body of Christ. Now, I've spoken to a local priest here about this and said, yeah, but okay, it's symbolic, isn't it? And he said, look, listen, I'm high church. When I do this, I am tasting the blood and body of Christ.
The concept of transubstantiation has been debated throughout history.
Yeah.
Do the wine and bread become the body and blood of Christ? And, you know, Anglicans, Protestants do not entirely believe that, but those of high church do, you know, Catholics do. I say that very, very broadly, and it is a concept that is still debated today. I mean, we're getting very much into the nitty-gritty of theological discussion.
Yeah.
But as you say, it all stems around eating. All of these feasts do, but we can then move into the idea of the senses in the historic era. And so we have to remember that the way that we taste, smell, see, etc., it's very different to the way that perhaps you would say in the medieval era, the way that you would taste, smell, see.
I guess so, yeah. Let's go back to the food traditions there. Let's start off with the hot cross bun. Tell me all about the hot cross bun.
Oh, the hot cross bun. Well, these were they were first introduced in the 12th century, we think, by a monk who put a cross on a bun, or bread bun, essentially. But what's so interesting is we get to the 16th century with Elizabeth I, and she thought that hot cross buns should only be reserved for special occasions. So Good Friday, Christmas, and burials. Mm. So essentially there was a bit too much popery associated with hot cross buns. So
yeah.
1592, she banned them. Except for these holidays. But that meant that everyone else started making them within their homes. And so we got variations of hot cross buns. And it was
basically feed the tradition even more by banning them.
Exactly. So they were circumventing the law by making them in their homes. But as a result, she couldn't implement this law. And so they started developing from there. And then when the embargo was lifted, and then by the early 18th century, then you start adding sweetness and spice and fruit, and buns were sold on the streets for, you know, one a penny, two a penny. And then, in fact, later on, when the British colonised Jamaica, they brought the hot cross buns with them, and they became savoury too.
Absolutely. So one a penny, two a penny. That's the first example of the bog off, isn't it? You buy one, get one free.
Yeah.
So it's always been around. Okay. And again, we're eating the cross. I mean, there's a pattern emerging here, isn't there? What about Easter eggs? I mean, are they a pagan thing or is there a Christian connection as well?
Eggs, of course, were one of the main food groups that are forbidden during the 40 days of Lent, which includes meat, fats, milk, and then eggs. Hmm. But any eggs laid during this period, particularly in the past, particularly in the medieval era, they would be boiled for preservation. You know, we're not wasting anything during this. And then Easter Sunday rolls around, pardon the pun, and eggs are back on the menu. And in fact, at Easter then, eggs would be brought by the peasants to their lords. It was a sort of customary rent, I suppose, and Thanksgiving. The Lord would reciprocate. I mean, there's a reference from Eleanor and Simon de Montfort in the 13th century who brought almost 4,000 eggs for celebrations. That's just how important they were.
Wow, yeah.
And even because they were so so forbidden, they actually became imitated. And so you got pretend eggs, fake eggs, imitation eggs, and dishes made to look like other foods. So we have a 15th century egg, which was made from almond paste. Some were made from picro, fish eggs, etc. And then they became painted with gold leaf. So
yeah, and the chocolate version of the egg, was that just inevitable, do you think?
Yeah, that's a little bit later on in sort of into the 19th century. It kind of goes hand in hand with the Easter Bunny as well.
Excellent. Tell us about the Easter Bunny.
I suppose all of this is pretty much a celebration, a party, let's just say. So party games emerged.
Yeah.
And there are suggestions that in the 16th century, you know, the German Protestant Martin Luther, he organized egg hunts for his congregation. And so it was to teach the lesson of Christ's resurrection. So they were emulating the disciples discovering the risen Christ on Easter morning. And then the idea formed, obviously, with bunnies and hares extremely fertile, association with the Virgin Mary as well.
But rabbits are mammals. They don't lay eggs. Why is there such a tight connection between eggs and mammals? It's just bizarre.
The idea of rebirth, renewal, fertility.
Yeah.
They all sort of do have a tenuous link, let's just say.
Yes, okay, yeah, I get that. But I mean, also what's interesting is you were talking about Lent, and Lent is a really interesting concept as well, because I know many of my friends who follow some sort of Lent, you know, denial to themselves, and they are completely unreligious. So what's clever about Lent is it taps into a human need for structures and for cycles and for marking a moment in time to be able to do something. Now, they, you know, my friends don't feel it's a religious thing, but they feel a sense of responsibility. And that, I think that's what's so clever about religion. You know, you're not just overlaying what you think, you're taking human needs and adapting them. Am I right, or am I clutching at straws now as well?
No, you're absolutely right. And I even thought this myself the other day when I saw a certain British coffee chain advertising hot cross bun, hot chocolates,
yeah,
and Easter cakes. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And what's so very interesting is that these religious traditions are under our noses every day, and we don't really realize that we are, you know, implementing them. And going back to even sort of the chocolate Easter eggs, you know, we think that they are just a modern idea, but yes, they are, I suppose, Victorian revival of these sort of imitation eggs that we found in the medieval era.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, egg hunts and all the like, but they were made because they were sort of a representation of family time and coming together and gathering. And because we see that change in the Victorian era of sort of family time was, you know, becoming less and less because, you know, for various different reasons, you know, even Queen Victoria, she held Easter egg hunts. So it's, as a result, we see, you know, fries, chocolate, they introduced the first Easter egg in the UK, but it all, in the marketing and advertising, all centered around food, gathering, coming together, spending time with family. So we're still doing it in just our modern way.
Yeah. We'll get back to the Victorians in a second. But first of all, let's talk a little bit about lamb. Now, lamb is classic for Easter, and I absolutely adore it. And, you know, does it relate to the phrase lamb of God and the sacrificial nature of his death? Or is that a tenuous link? Is it just something that was good to eat at that time of year?
All of the above, essentially. Easter was the Paschal month for Christ. He's the Paschal. He's the sacrificed lamb of God. But above all, Easter Day, Easter Sunday, marked the return of the meat diet. You weren't eating meat during Lent. I say that broadly because in the past, it was mainly the, you know, the upper classes that were eating meat. It was plant-based diet, essentially, for those lower classes, the peasants.
Gruel-based diet.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, pottage and the like. But the roots of why lamb is served in Christian households stems from, again, Passover, Judaism, the observances before even the birth of Christianity. And we're even going back to the biblical Exodus and, you know, the Egyptians are enduring those terrible plagues, the death of all the firstborns, and they painted their doorposts, the Jewish Egyptians, with sacrificed lamb's blood.
Yeah.
And so that God would pass over and watch over their homes while these punishments were going on. So they sort of converted this tradition, if you will, into Easter lamb and eating of the lamb, and then Christianity symbolized self-sacrifice and Jesus' sacrifice. So it all goes together, not to mention, obviously, that lambs are available after winter for slaughter.
Yeah.
They're a fruit.
Spring lambs, yeah, it's at their best. Hello there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out our series where we meet some of the most innovative food businesses being showcased at Expo 2020 Dubai. There are editions on transforming the desert into fertile land, on providing employment for refugees in Malaysia, and a new model to deal with food insecurity in Japan. Take a listen at foodmatterslive.com. And now, back to the chat. Now let's talk about pancakes then. Obviously fundamental to my version of Easter. Very basic. It's the one recipe in any of my cookbooks that I've written that my kids actually use. It's literally you can't open the pages anymore. It's covered in batter. But why are they so popular, and what's the tradition behind them?
Well, I suppose they're so popular because they're so easy. I say easy. I suppose not tossing a pancake, but they are very simple to make. But Shrove Tuesday, so the day before Ash Wednesday, start of Lent, it presents an opportunity. You eat up everything you have that you can't take with you, essentially, on the journey of Lent. So eggs, yep. Fat, milk, etc. Make them into pancakes. But in fact, pancakes, as a foodstuff, go back to ancient Greece and Rome. And the Greeks, they sweetened theirs with honey, if we're calling them pancakes, of course, because we have all different versions of pancakes. So as we know them, they go back to ancient Greece and Rome.
Yeah.
And then one of the first recipes is from the 15th century. And, you know, of course, everything that's added to them is far more modern, from, you know, chocolate spreads and the like. But they do seem to be quite an ancient food form.
And Pancake Day is itself as a day. Is it part of a festival or a feast day?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly historic. As I say, Shrove Tuesday marked the final decision to sacrifice for Lent, and so it was also a time of feast and events and just hanging out with friends, I suppose, as so many of these festivals are. But there are many traditions that surround it, which I suppose has become our Pancake Day. There was a Shrove bell rung on Shrove Tuesday, and it signified that essentially the end of the workday. You know, you're free to go. You got an extra couple of shillings in your paycheck to go out and enjoy the day. And then as a result, and it wasn't just a high feast day, it was for the laity, for everyone. And as a result, people would go out and play football games because they were all together and they could. And so this idea of, it's very common and very connected tradition, is football with Shrove Tuesday.
That's extraordinary, yeah. Well, so and the word Shrove, what is it to shrive?
Essentially penance, just sacrifice, yeah. There are 12th century references to ball games, I suppose, Shrovetide ball games. Mm. So I suppose our concept of football might be slightly different, I believe, than the early football games. But
I think it was a bit more violent, wasn't it? It was basically, let's have a fight and there might be a ball there as well.
But actually, football games in churches was very common. People did play them on Sundays. There's many, many early accounts of priests getting rather frustrated, wow, saying, get yourselves into mass. Get out of the foot, and they would break the walls because they use them as goalposts. Honestly, it's palaver.
That is really interesting. Okay, simnel cake. Now, simnel cake is one of those weird things. It has never been part of my life. I've never tasted it in my entire life. Tell me all about it.
I don't like marzipan, so I haven't either. Oh, this is a difficult one, actually, because essentially we don't know really where it comes from. But
oh, I love a don't know. That's all good for me. That's great. Yeah.
To start, they do go back very far, and it is a Latin word which is similar. It means finely ground wheat and flour, I suppose.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it first appears about the 11th century, I think, in sources. We have Edward the Confessor, and he talks about 100 simnels and hogshead of wine and all that sort of thing in his annals. But the word simnel was used to describe it was a type of cake, which it is. Then you get into the 17th century and you have simnel flour, simnel bread, they become to recede from view, and you get simnel cake moving center stage. It was about that time, though, it actually gained association with Mothering Sunday rather than Easter. That seems to come 100 or 200 years later.
Okay, yeah.
And I suppose it derives from the idea that people were giving simnel cakes for blessing, I suppose. She would receive a blessing in return to the son who gave it, that sort of thing. So Mothering Sunday was bound up with the idea of giving sweet and tasty foods, you know, cakes sort of thing. But butter and cream were obviously forbidden during Lenten time. So you would make them out to different things. Simnel cake was therefore ideally suited. After that, though, just to round up, because it gets even more complicated or more ambiguous, we get to the 19th century, and then the legend of Simon and Nell, Simnel, appears. And there's a whole poem, but just to sum up, which appeared in 1838, it was Simon's opinion to mould it and bake it, while Nell, a true woman, protested 'twould spoil it. And so they have an argument and essentially agree to do it both ways. And that's what we get for Easter. It moves from Mother and Sunday, into Easter.
Bringing them all together. Okay. Now, we've talked a lot about British traditions and a lot about the sort of the simple bits. But I mean, Easter is an enormous event for loads of people around the world. What is very different? Can you tell us a few traditions from abroad that might surprise us?
Yeah, I suppose the first one is borscht, the traditional Polish soup. And I believe at Easter it's called Zurek. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, so I apologise. But it's a soup with egg, sausages and potatoes. And it's made with items essentially in a basket of food, and you would give them to friends and family on Holy Saturday. Going right back to the medieval era, still done. So it's again that sort of sign of blessing for a bountiful year ahead. In Brazil, though, we get fish rather than lamb or anything else, cod recipes.
And any particular reason for fish? Is it the sort of connection with Jesus and fish generally? Or
yeah, which we still connect to with Easter Sunday and Good Friday, etc. So, of course, Brazil is a very Catholic country. So all of these have their origins in Catholicism. And there's a common recipe with fish cut with vegetables. So it's all very similar. Then there's pashka, which is a Russian dessert, which is actually in the shape of a pyramid. If you haven't seen it, then you must.
Excellent.
And it's to represent the tomb of Christ. It kind of looks like a blancmange sort of esque, moussey sort of thing. But it's got religious symbolisms all over it, saying, you know, Christ is risen. And it's made with cheese, butter, egg, sugar, you know, all the things you can't consume during Lent. And I suppose finally I have to mention this one, which is Naples pizza. and this is not stereotypical. According to tradition, on Good Friday, consumed on Holy Saturday, but it's not quite a traditional pizza. I think it's pronounced Chiena. So again, and do correct me if I'm wrong, Italians. Tastes slightly different to traditional pizza, and it's round, a bit like, you know, of course, the egg.
Yeah, throwing your symbols in there. Why not?
Yeah. And the dough contains lard and various different, of course, cured meats and cheeses and eggs and things, you know, opulent foods that you couldn't have during Lent.
The French galette de roi, is that an Easter tradition? Can you tell us a bit about that?
I believe so, yes, I think it is.
So basically it's a pastry-heavy kind of sweet pie that always has a coin in it, I think, and you're supposed to find the coin and whoever gets the coin gets good luck.
Yeah, which is
something like that.
I believe so. But again, we're going back to Christmas traditions too. So all of these have this idea of blessings and giving bounty ahead, that sort of thing. Yeah,
which is all good. Okay, now back to the role of the food industry itself. Now, when we think about Christmas, there's a huge amount of stuff which has been pushed by the food industry, picked up from the Victorian era, which is when I would, you know, when you really think that mass production of food and commercialization of food really kicked in. Is it the same with Easter? Are there things that the food industry has basically created that maybe weren't necessarily a massive tradition? Or is it all rooted in stuff that was already there?
I suppose yes and no is the answer to that. I think we see this sort of Victorian revival of Easter, as we see with so many different food items and feasting and events. And the Victorians do have a lot. I suppose they created our Christmas too, so it's Easter and Christmas. Yeah. But as I said, it wasn't until the Victorian era that we get sort of chocolate Easter eggs, that we get Easter hunts that were very popular in the way that we do them, I suppose, still today. which, as I say, had its relationship to family time, and everyone had, well, most people had slightly higher disposable income, so you could spend them on your children and family time and eggs and chocolate. And so you do tend to start to see the birth of modern Easter, because you had toys, you had novelty items, you had chocolate eggs, which came over often from France and Germany. So I would say that they all seem to have their origins in the past. You know, the concept of the egg is obviously centuries old, millennia old, but we've just modernized it and updated it.
And in terms of chocolate, you know, it was the engineering sort of advances around food technology around then for production of chocolate, which is a very complex affair. And you mentioned Fry's earlier on, and there were lots of other Quaker organizations, Cadbury's and the like. And they really grabbed everything. They're very commercial, and they grabbed anything that would be successful and I guess molded that with tradition as well.
I think that's a very good point, because a lot of our modern chocolatiers, if you will, have been born out of the Christian faith. A lot of them were Quakers or Methodists. You know, the Roundtree's family, Fry's, I believe, and I think even the Cadbury family were too.
So now, obviously, you're a historian, so... What do you think about the modern version of Easter? Is it a bastard form of something that used to be purer and more meaningful? Or, you know, are you slightly scornful of it and thinking, come on, guys, there's more to this. Dig a bit deeper and you might find something that it tells you more about yourself.
Yeah, perhaps. I think that's the case. Now, saying that, I have noticed, you know, even on social media, a lot of people observe Lent. You know, they do make the sacrifices. It is a way of stopping ourselves doing things we shouldn't, you know, in the simplest of sense. If everyone else is doing it, it's very easy to do that. So I think yes and no. And as I say, seeing Easter eggs and hot crust bun, hot chocolates and coffee, one might frown on that. But a lot of our traditions are rooted in religion and in faith. And if we're still observing them in different ways, is that a problem? If you are observing the Christian traditions, continue on. But if we're making them more secular, and I use that term very loosely, we have done this for hundreds of years. I mean, the medieval church was filled with secular events which were connected to more holy feasts. So it's always been sort of sacred and profane. We've always seen that with every Christian feast, and everyone, this argument rears its ugly head throughout history.
Yeah, and same with Christmas. You know, I am not Christian anyway, but gosh, I love my Christmas. Okay, now what about the future of Easter? I mean, you know, most things we've talked about are very much not vegan, that's for sure. And we are looking at a big drift in culture away from animal protein, dairy, all these things which are fundamental to Easter. Do you think that Easter will become more important because that's the time when people will take a break from veganism or flexitarianism or whatever their version of it, and focus even more on having lamb and chocolate and pastries and all these things that they wouldn't normally have, and then keep their veganism or their vegetarianism to other periods of the year? Or do you think that we are seeing the possibility that a lot of these traditions may actually just fall out of favour and disappear?
Oh gosh, now that's a question. I don't think they will. Those who observe them as Christian traditions will continue to do so. And just because lamb is the main food source of a meal doesn't mean you couldn't have, I don't know, corn instead. That's your sacrificial lamb. You know, we have fake turkeys at Christmas and all the like. So what's the difference? If there is a reason that you are celebrating, you know, you are observing that tradition, you're observing the religious origins and why you're doing that, never changes. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, and after all, these are symbols. It's not the thing, it's a symbol of the thing. So that could be
anything. Yeah, it's a representation of, you know, the sacrificial lamb, etc. And throughout history, as we've said, plant-based diet was far more prevalent than meat, unless you were, you know, of the upper classes. It was extremely, extremely expensive. So we've sort of gone back, we've sort of come full circle, like, you know, renewal, renaissance again, a bit like Christ.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now, if you could revive one traditional food from the past or from another culture that you think we should consume here in the UK, or choose a dish from anywhere around the world, what would it be?
See, this is difficult because there are so many. We still eat these dishes. But what I would say is I think there are certain traditions that I think should be revived, which include a foodstuff. So I'm getting right. Been sneaky and getting around your question.
Yeah, no, I like it. Liking your work there.
So something called egg jarping, which is a little bit similar to conkers. And so two players sort of tap the pointed ends of the eggs together until one breaks, obviously.
I love that. I mean, obviously do it over a bowl, children, so that you don't waste food. There we go.
You can put goggles on or something.
That is a genius idea. I could play that with my girls, actually. That would be fantastic.
There are others like hop egg or egg dancing. Eggs are laid on the ground and the aim is sort of...
You're all about the eggs, aren't you?
Oh, it's Easter, isn't it?
It's Easter, isn't it? Yeah, okay. Okay, so my very last question then for you is, what will you be eating for your Easter meal?
An Easter egg. I don't eat lamb.
And is that going to be a chocolate Easter egg?
There's a very traditional... chocolatier near where I live in North Yorkshire, so that would probably give it away. Yeah. And that does Easter eggs about the size, what are we, 30 inches plus.
Size of a car.
Yeah. And I have been prone to receive those as gifts.
You've just said that to make sure you do definitely get one this year, haven't you?
I mean, they do last until the next year, so you know.
Dr. Emma Wells, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure discovering all about Easter with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Excellent. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are plenty more at foodmatterslive.com, including a whole history of series. We've covered the history of chocolate, the history of tea and Christmas dinner, and there are lots more on their way. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.